the What I Watch Tonight show.
Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever you are in the world, and welcome to the first special episode of Pottercasts from What I Watch Tonight. We decided against calling it Podcasts, as it may have drawn in the wrong crowd. My name is Matt Hudson, and joining me from across the world, days, and time zones is somebody who is the possessor of a truly marvellous jacket, and my magnificent co-host, the wonderful...
Morgan Maria, sorry. I was trying so hard to come in at the right time, but you had me thinking about my jacket again. I was thinking it's kind of sad because no one can see it. It's a podcast, so.
Well, for those of you out there, check out Morgan's work and socials and you'll see just what I mean. It's a superb jacket. Joseph himself in a Technicolor Dreamcoat would have been jealous of this one.
A modern day Technicolor Dreamcoat, probably.
Yes, it is a fabulous coat. How on earth are you doing?
Pretty good. It's 8 a.m. in New Zealand. It's a little bit chilly as well, so we're doing okay. We're waking up.
Yeah, and it's the evening on the... I mentioned this on our last chat. It's the day before for me, which still utterly bends my head. And it's a little cold here as well. I've got a cup of tea. I know you've got a cup of coffee. So hopefully between us, that will sustain us through this.
Hopefully.
And, well, as the name suggests, Pottercasts. It's four special episodes where Morgan and myself are going to cover two movies from the Rowling-verse per show, Rowling, whichever one you want to say. And we talk about what was good, what wasn't so good. We dive into the movies and how Ron Weasley is permanently peckish. So grab your Quidditch brooms and your toilet trolls because, Megan, it's time to get our Potter on. What are we talking about first?
Yes, we're talking about Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Obviously starting at the start, the right place to start.
It's true, then, what they're saying on the train. Harry Potter has come to Hogwarts.
Hermione Granger?
Gryffindor!
Ronald Weasley?
Gryffindor!
Harry Potter?
Gryffindor!
Oh, are you doing magic? Let's see, then.
Sunshine, daisies, buttermellow. Turn this stupid fat rat yellow.
I wondered when I'd be seeing you, Mr. Potter.
It seems only yesterday that your mother and father were in here buying their first wands.
Who are you?
Rubeus Hagrid, keeper of keys and grounds at Hogwarts.
Good luck today, Potter. Then again, now that you've proven yourself against a troll, a little game of Quidditch should be easy work for you. Even if it is against Slytherin.
Harry Potter receives 150 points for catching the snitch. Gryffindor wins!
We know about the Philosopher's Stone!
Oh.
I think it is clear that we can expect great things from you. After all, he who must not be named did
Oh, and I suppose a great muggle like yourself's going to stop him, are you?
This is platform 9 3/4. There's no such thing, is there?
There will be no foolish wand waving or silly incantations in this class.
If you two don't mind, I'm going to bed before either of you come up with another clever idea to get us killed. Or worse, expelled.
She needs to sort out her priorities.
You're a wizard, Harry.
Forget to live. 2001, this film is what, 17 years old now?
Oh,
does that
God.
Make you at all feel quite old?
Well, 2001, you said?
Yes.
I was 7 years old, so yes, that makes me feel quite old.
Yeah, sorry about that. And I imagine everybody listening to this probably grew up with the book, so they're probably starting to check their hair as well now. So apologies for starting off on a grey-haired note. But it didn't feel like that long ago, unless that's just me.
Oh my God, 2001. Oh, you don't think about it until you think about it.
That's 17 years ago.
Yeah. Oh, Christ.
So you were seven. The three guys who were cast, Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, and of course Emma Watson, they were 11 when they were cast. I think Rupert Grint was near enough 12, but semantics. But 11 years old to be cast in a film like this. So I guess the first question is, Philosopher's Stone, what did you think about it?
Oh, I love it. I think that, honestly, like, this is going to get worse as we go through the movies. But I think we're starting in the right place, because that is the film of the Harry Potter series that I think I have the most love for. It's very nostalgic. And, yeah, you kind of just watch it and you just feel good inside, as opposed to, you know, when you get down the track with maybe, like, the fourth or the sixth movie and you're just thinking, good God, this is not in the books. So you don't have that worry with the first one. Yeah.
Yeah, Chris Columbus, who directed this and the next film, he did pretty much keep it as close as possible to the books, I think.
Yeah.
And I know J.K. Rowling, she was there to help lend a helping hand, and did also say that, you know, if there was a good idea, we can incorporate it, but as long as it fits within the story. Did you go to see this when it came out, or were you a latecomer to the Potter family?
It's so hard to say. I don't know what I was doing when I was 7 years old. I know that I was probably a latecomer to the Harry Potter series. I do think that I read the books, like, myself, actually reading them myself after I had seen the movies, because I always had Daniel Radcliffe, Emma Watson, and Rupert Grint as my Harry, Hermione, and Ron in my head. I never had that, you know, coming up with your own faces problem. So I don't know whether I saw it in the movies. I probably wouldn't remember even if I did.
It was 17 long years ago now.
So long ago.
And you've been blinded by that fabulous jacket. So,
since.
This film made a ton of money. It made about nearly $1 billion worldwide. So it was clear that this was at the time a phenomenon. Nowadays, for inflation, I can't only imagine how much it would be worth now. And it got nominated for a few Oscars for art direction, costume design, and good old John Williams for his score. So it's certainly a film that's held up. And it has the wonderful performance of Alan Rickman. And, of course, dear old Richard Harris as Dumbledore.
Yes. Oh, some fantastic actors in that series. Like, I know that there's a joke that England has, like, six actors. But, you know, the six that you have are really great, you know? I have to say that.
Yeah. And there's a bit in the next film, which we're going to talk about, where two of England's finest actors go wand to wand.
Yes.
Yes, I said that. all of the cast pretty much is British, which is what J.K. Rowling wanted, and it's all filmed in the lovely British Isles, which is quite nice. And Harry's house in Privet Drive was filmed about half an hour from where I used to live, or where I grew up. I haven't seen it, but I know where it is.
Oh, you haven't seen it? You didn't go?
No, I didn't, because. Well, I just didn't. But
it's like living in Auckland and not going to see Hobbiton. That's pathetic.
We've only been on this call for about 5 minutes, and I've been called pathetic by someone in the future.
Well, maybe I just know things.
Yeah, being in the future, yes. Well, Christ, what am I going to get up to later on? Oh, no. Take it offline. So jumping into the film, probably best to start at the beginning, because that's where most films start. The first thing I thought when I saw this film recently was, ew, there's a creepy old man wandering in the streets at night. And then I thought, fucking hell, he's just called his cat a professor. This is utterly mental. Maybe we should have called this podcasts. It very quickly, the cat becomes Professor McGonagall, and the creepy old man is in fact the wonderful Dumbledore. So sorry, J.K. Rowling, for misconstruing your characters. It doesn't take any time getting into the story, so we quickly learn that Harry has been dumped onto his auntie and uncle because his parents have been slain by a rogue wizard. And it's clear, obviously, that his auntie and uncle aren't very nice people.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
Yeah, and his cousin Dudley is an absolute punk.
Yes, I think that oh, just the most unbearable characters. But I think that they're played very well in the film. Like, when you're reading the book, you absolutely despise them with the very core of your being. And you don't feel any different when you watch the movie, but you can appreciate that they are doing their role very well. And that it must be tough to be such an insufferable character, surely.
Well, yeah. The first time I saw Dudley, he really wound me up the wrong way. In a booting Potter back into the cupboard under the stairs and just moaning about gifts. You think, I could throttle you. And he plays that camp so well. And Richard Griffiths, as the uncle, is superb. But like you say, it's written well and they're played so well that you are very quickly rooting for this young boy with a bowl cut.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And then, I don't know, and it's especially the first movie that they do their roles so well that it's some of the most memorable quotes. Like, but last year I had 37. And it's like, damn, I'm going to remember that for the rest of my life. And I'm going to remember his voice saying that. But like, no post on Sundays. It's just very memorable. I think exactly. They do it fantastically.
And then obviously when Hagrid comes bursting through the door, he utters the line, "You're a wizard, Harry. I can't do the British accent quite like you, so I'm not going to try." It starts so quickly. I mean, if within sort of 20 minutes, you've met their horrible family, and obviously we've mentioned the snake incident in the zoo, which was quite funny.
Yes. So key for the later movies, I think, that, you know, his first
especially the next one
with magic was with a snake. So, yeah, I think that that's really interesting and obviously very deliberate by J.K. Rowling, obviously, but just fantastic.
Yeah, and it's all so very British, I found, when I first saw it and obviously rewatching it to do these, I'd forgotten just how British it is. Everything about it is, I thought, God blimey, ma'am, your majesty would be proud of this. It's so British. That's not a bad thing, of course.
I have to take your word for it. Like, I guess it is, you know, they're drinking tea in their houses and they've got British accents. But, I mean, I don't know Britain. I've never been. What's very quintessentially British about it?
Pretty much what you've just said. Obviously the accents, the because that's British. But yeah, the tea. It's a tea. Even though it's imported, it's never been in English.
Yes.
That is like an English staple. Just the visuals, just the locations they go to, and of course they are in Britain, so they're going to look it. But I guess Lord of the Rings, that was more the exterior shots. But I guess to you that feels like home or New Zealand possibly. But just seeing some of the shots, the exterior shots, the interiors, how the characters are, the Privet Drive where they live, that looks like a very nice sort of British housing estate.
Yeah,
I don't know, it's just everything about it just has that lovely feeling of home for me about it.
Well, that's good then, because it means that I do know England.
Yeah,
the amount of times I've read these books, I feel like I've been there now. Then,
yeah, all those stereotypes you've heard about are true. Apart from our teeth aren't that bad.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. Yes, you didn't sound at all like you believe me with that one, by the way. But
I'll leave it until I get to the country.
Yeah, well, when you come over, if you ever come over, you'll see just what I mean. You'll be transported into Potterland as soon as you touch down at Heathrow Airport or wherever it is you touch down. So
awesome. I look forward to it.
What I do like about the film, certainly the first part, half, it's that the first half is a lot more playful. Obviously, it's just the kids getting to know each other, getting their gear from Diagon Alley. It all just feels a bit, I don't know, more breezy, a lot more colourful, and a lot more playful. And obviously, as it goes on, it gets, you know, things get going a bit more in the second half.
Yeah.
And when Hagrid takes, like I say, Potter to get his wand from Diagon Alley and everything he needs. There's also one moment. This might be slightly off key, but when Hagrid taps his pocket. And he says, Dumbledore will be after this. And it sounds like an awful lot like Dumbledore's just a coke addict. That's the way he's off. It's like, Dumbledore will be after this. I thought, oh, come on.
Innuendos and hidden messages in the movie.
Yes, I'm glad it's not just me, because I watched it and thought, it just looks like he's just like gone and got him a secret stash. But one thing I will say, and at the risk of being on the receiving end of a Petrificus Totalis spell, the child acting, the children, the performances, I don't think they're that great.
Well, no, they're not, are they? I mean, good. I was going to say that probably the worst part of the film is when they're all falling down the trapdoor at the end of the film and they're yelling and they're going, with the blankest faces on.
Yeah, it's a sound that they've just woken up and it could just shout,
Yeah, it was just very lackluster. But I mean, you've got to hand it to them. They really pick it up because I think that it's quite dangerous to, not dangerous, but you know, it can be quite risky hiring child actors when you know that they have to carry a franchise for 10 years. You're like, well, they could grow up and be a really crap actor. But they did pretty good, I think. You know, like, they really got their shit together.
Well, I feel bad saying it because, like I said, they're 11 years old. And when I was 11 years old, I was probably just working out how to pick my nose and flick it. But these guys are... Oh, that's disgusting. These guys are carrying, like you say, not even thinking about the other seven movies, but this film itself was like ushering in this, what was going to become this huge thing for so many people around the world. And it fell on the shoulders of three kids.
Yeah.
Three kids who also had no experience. I mean, Rupert Grint, he'd literally only just done like school plays and that was all he'd ever done.
Yeah. They just did amazing. And then, but you know, when you hear, I don't know if you do hear this, but a lot of internet memes about how younger kids these days are growing up so fast and they're so much better at, you know, lots of different things than we were as kids because of social media. As a girl, you see a lot of them, like, of young girls who dress really well and do their makeup really well. When you were that age, you were looking sort of like a potato. And I think that this is sort of a similar situation because you look at the Stranger Things kids who are the same age as the Golden Trio and Harry Potter, but their acting is just amazing. It's unbelievable. So you wonder sort of how they jumped ahead, but I still think that the Harry Potter trio did well. They did great. They got there.
Yeah. As the movie went on, they got significantly worse. But I can only be honest, but it was almost like sort of kicking a puppy when you say it. But
yeah,
there were times when I did think, they should have reshot that particular scene.
Yeah,
a lot of it is, and some of it is just actually the dialogue between them, and which at times is very good. And again, they're 11-year-old kids, and they do so well. But at times, you can tell
it's clunky. Did you notice how Emma Watson says everyone's lines while they're talking? She's miming them.
I didn't notice that.
Because she memorised every single line in the script that she was in, the scenes that she would be in, which is a very Hermione thing to do, I think. So you can see in some scenes that she's miming what every other character is saying while they say it as well. Yeah.
I never noticed that, and now I'm going to have to go back and...
Dedication. She's a bit of a nerd, just like her character, so, yeah.
Well, clearly. I'm quite annoyed that I didn't notice that. I'm going to go back and sort of, I'm going to Google it or something and just see what I can find about that, because I never noticed that. She's obviously either I just wasn't paying attention, or she's very good at concealing it.
It's only in a few scenes that you see it. I think that they probably caught on that she was doing it and tried to stop her, or, you know, tried to get the right scenes without it. But yeah, very, very Hermione. I think all of the actors as well are very much like their characters. Like, have you seen, they were doing an interview, I think it must have been after the second film, and they were and the interviewer was asking them what they were doing with all their money from Harry Potter. And Emma Watson said that she would put it in the bank and save it for when she's 18. Harry said that, Daniel Radcliffe, I can't remember what he said, but I think it was something like, I'm going to save a little bit of it. And then Rupert Grint said that he was just going to blow it on lollies, basically. So they're very, very, like, they're very much their characters, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, and especially Rupert / Ron. It looks like he's just a kid who's just turned up on set and just joined in with the rest of them.
Yeah.
It's so much, and I mean that in a positive way, it just looks like he's coming on and having a lot of fun with what he's doing. And it does look like it's just an extension of himself. I read that Daniel Radcliffe got paid £1 million for this role.
Oh my gosh.
And then just said, and then said, you know, I wasn't really worried about the money. I thought, I bet your parents were.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Oh, that's a very Harry thing to say as well, although he doesn't have to worry about money.
Well, not in the film or in real life. And I know, I'm sure we'll get into Daniel Radcliffe as each episode progresses. because I like Daniel Radcliffe. I think he's a very good actor. And I think he's come along an awful lot since that first film, because who hasn't? I think, yeah. I'm sure most actors look back at their first film and think, ooh. He certainly looked like the character as well. From the front covers of the books I remember seeing, they certainly picked somebody who looks a lot like Harry Potter.
Yeah, they did. They did great with that. I mean, I think they did bang on with all of them. You know, I think, well, obviously, it's kind of hard to, again, when you're getting actors so young and you need them to, you know, carry themselves a certain way for the next, you know, decade, it's kind of tough. So, you know, they could have never known that Rupert wouldn't really be tall and lanky when he grew up. I think that they did pretty well with what they had, yeah. I think that they did great casting for most of the characters. Like, I could not picture Snape or McGonagall as anyone else, not for the life of me. I think
absolutely
that they got
not.
This. Yeah.
I mean, Alan Rickman is one of those six British actors, as you mentioned. rest in peace, Sir Alan. But he is across the board in all of these films, but in these ones we're going to talk about today, he's just fantastic. Alan Rickman's always had that certain sort of brooding menace, but you never, it's always kind of just barely concealed beneath the surface. He's fantastic, I think, Alan Rickman is. And in this particular role, nobody else could have played it like him, I don't think.
Oh, gosh, no. And I remember the first time I saw him without the wig, and I thought, this is not, like, he just seemed to really, you know, that greasy wig really seemed to match him and the whole
thing. Who's this imposter without the wig?
Yeah, and to find out that he's actually this really charming guy.
Yeah.
Just polarizing, I think, was an experience that I had when I found that out. I was so shocked.
When he realised that wasn't his actual hair.
Yeah, yeah. I couldn't believe it.
But he's so good at playing villains. Obviously, he played Hans Gruber in Die Hard, the Sheriff of Nottingham in that Robin Hood film. But he's always been so good at playing sort of villainous characters, or characters with that kind of sinister edge almost. And
like how he breaks his wife's heart in Love Actually. That was a moment for me. It's okay seeing him as a villain, but seeing him be a really unfaithful husband, that was too far.
you could mess Potter around, Rickman, but do not break anyone's heart.
Yeah, that's right.
What you can't see is I'm visually pointing at somebody who's not there now. I'm getting angry. And obviously you've got the wonderful Richard Harris, who takes up the mantle of Dumbledore in these two films. Who I thought had a real nice pathos about him. The way he carried himself with that kind of light authority. And he's almost like a really nice granddad.
He was as old as time in that film. He just really seemed so old, but so perfectly Dumbledore. I think that he was, I mean, rest in peace, but he was perfect for the role. And he wasn't going to take it, was he?
He wasn't.
Yeah, he didn't want
it. His granddaughter had a say, I think, if I'm correct.
Yeah. Which is lucky for us, I think, because he had a great Dumbledore for the first two films.
Yeah, and again, this is probably going to be a phrase that one of us will mutter a lot, but as we get across the episodes, we'll obviously have a chance to compare, if you will, the change in, the obviously necessary change in cast. But in terms of this film, yeah, that's another casting choice which just worked. I mean, off camera, he was an old wild child when he was growing up. Richard Harris was an absolute hellraiser, but to see him in this kind of role was a fantastic kind of about turn, and he's a brilliant actor.
Yeah. Oh, I didn't know anything about him outside of Harry Potter, but I'm from New Zealand, so that's what I'm using as my excuse.
He may have been outside of those six British actors, so nobody in the world knows him, I thought. No, he was in Camelot in the 60s, and he's just a brilliant, brilliant actor. So, I guess, what were some of your favourite moments of the film? Because by the sounds of it, there's probably going to be quite a few, judging by your love for this film, I guess.
I guess I can't say the whole film, can I?
You can do.
Because it would be that. But I think I really love the scene in Diagon Alley when they first go there. That's beautiful. I think that's really, really charming, and I don't think that I could ever have visualized that place in my head without seeing it in film, because there's just so much going on, and they've got the music playing and he's seeing all of this magic stuff. It's just this magic stuff, like the way to term it. But, yeah, I think that it's it really sets the film up for what the magic world is like, which is quite old-timey, but also really charming and colourful and exciting. So I think that's probably my first favourite scene. And then anything at Hogwarts, just anything.
Well, charming is such a good word to describe that, because, I mean, like I said earlier on, that there's something about those sort of opening, that opening gambit of about the first half an hour or so, 40 minutes, everything just feels very fantastical, which is just how it should do. And that's the mixture of the visuals, the colours, the music, the acting, the locations. Everything just comes together to really quickly create this wizarding world. And you're quite right that those scenes in Diagon Alley really do set up quite a lot and starts the lore and mythology off quite quickly as well.
Yes, I think so. And I think, well, I always feel like Harry Potter, like the Philosopher's Stone, is a Christmas movie because it just has that perfect music. Mm-hmm. You know, there's snow in it. They've got all these fun things like sweets and stuff. It just all feels very Christmassy, even if it's only got one Christmas scene.
But Hogwarts in the snow looks superb.
Yeah, that's what I imagine like all of England looks like. So don't disappoint me.
You're going to be disappointed when you go to certain places. I can't say anywhere in case I have anyone who listens from there. I don't want to alienate Ellie. There are some places which could probably best be described as a dump. But,
don't ruin it.
Sorry, no, it's all like that. Yeah. Everything you've ever thought, it looks like that.
Perfect. Great. I knew it.
It snows all the time as well. I'm not sure if you know that.
Oh, yeah, no, I figured, yeah.
I've actually got a massive pointy hat now and a beard, so it's just something else you should know.
Oh, you're all wizards. Okay.
Yes. So I've got my wizarding robe and you've got your funky coat, so together we make it work. And you mentioned, obviously, that about it has got that awesome Christmassy vibe, and I think some of that is due to John Williams' music, because he's such a maestro. But, and I think this, I mean, I might get flack for this, but I think this film works best as a fun kids movie, kind of like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory of years gone by. It's a fun kids film which can be enjoyed by adults, and like you've said, as the films go along, obviously that tone changes quite drastically, but this one is very much that kind of...
It's like a same... drug into the rest of the Harry Potter films, you know? They get you hooked young. And
yeah.
They hold on to you for another 10 years or so.
Yes, it was whatever was in Hagrid's pocket was dispersed to all of us.
Yes, probably. I would say so. Definitely, I think I got my fair share. I was, there was a time when my dad thought that I was never going to read another book that wasn't Harry Potter.
They're not bad books to read as a kid, though, because they're not exactly small.
No, they're not. I mean, the fifth book is the size of a fridge, so... I mean, I don't know how I did. I used to read them back, like I would read them the normal direction, so from start to finish, and then
good.
Finished, yeah, you know, the normal way. And then once I'd finished the series, I would then go backwards. So then I would read the sixth book, and then I would read the fifth book, and then I would just do that on repeat forever.
That's an interesting way of like reading books. Yeah, you're clearly addicted to something. Bloody hell.
Yep, Harry Potter was a big thing for me.
Yes, just sitting there doing copious lines of Potter every night.
Yeah, basically.
Best moments. The Quidditch game, I think, was just a fun little interlude in the middle of it.
Yeah.
It reminded me a lot of, I don't know if you've seen it, but the Phantom Menace, the first Star Wars film.
Have I seen the Phantom Menace?
I know you're a Star Wars fan, but I must just assume you've seen it. But it reminded me of that. We've got the pod racing scene in the middle.
Yeah.
It's kind of so 10 minutes of just fun.
Yeah. And I think actually that's excitement. A really good comparison. You've got sort of the bad guys, and doing quotation marks in the air, you just can't see it. The bad guys are your competitors and they're trying to knock you off your broom or your speed racer. And I just think, yeah, really good comparison. And they're so young as well, the two of them. Really great.
Pat myself on the back.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, just to remark. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. It just reminded me of it because it was a kind of the moment in the middle of film where it just kind of the pace just picked up very quickly, and suddenly you've got this massive rush of excitement out of nowhere almost. Which then obviously, and then it goes back into the story. So I like that, and also I'm a sports fan anyway, so it's nice to see a bit of sport in there.
I think the only sport I enjoy is Quidditch. So
have you ever played it?
No, I live in New Zealand. We don't actually have flying brooms. We just kind of sad. Yeah, no magic.
Before you continue taking the piss out of me, I did Google Quidditch, and there is actually a real life Quidditch championship, which I found slightly disconcerting because people hold the brooms.
Yeah, but obviously they can't fly. I think it's kind of
except New Zealand.
Well, we don't really have it in New Zealand. I think they probably do it at unis for a bit of a laugh, but I've never been lucky enough to partake in a real Quidditch game, unfortunately.
Would you be a seeker, do you think?
Oh, God, no. I have zero hand-eye coordination. I think I would be a beater just because I would probably accidentally whack people constantly. I don't think I'd make a team,
if
I'm being honest. I don't think I'd make it.
Well, don't put yourself down. You never know. Harry didn't think he could make the team, and Harry did.
Yeah, but he's the youngest seeker in a decade or whatever. A century. He's a
celebrity as well.
Yes, yeah. He's got a lot going for him. I don't think that I have it in my blood to be a seeker. I don't know.
Anything's possible.
Commentator.
You'd probably be quite a good commentator.
Yeah, I'd be... Oh, I'd be the Luna Lovegood of commentators, but I think we're jumping ahead there.
Possibly, maybe a more foul-mouthed version, but...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Cover your ears, kids, because Muggle McGregor's in town and she will offend you. In the best way possible.
Hopefully.
Well, there's another small scene I liked, and it literally is only quite a small scene, but it's a scene in the library where Harry snuck in with his invisibility cloak to try and get... the book he seeks, and obviously as he's sort of sneaking out, you see a scene where the Snape is looking like he's threatening Quill, and as we find out, in fact, he's protecting Harry. But that scene I liked because it actually set up a little bit of mystery, because it kind of played into the fact that we all thought Snape is going to be the bad guy, and that Quill was like this sort of quivering weirdo. But I liked that because at the time when you're watching it, it looks like, hold on, it's starting to unravel now. There's a mystery here, but we know that Snape's the bad guy.
Yeah.
And the payoff to that worked quite well. So that was just one of those smaller moments which I appreciated. And also it's another scene of Alan Rickman doing what he does best.
I think it's always embarrassing when I think about how I well, I still don't like Snape, but it's for different reasons now. But I was always so adamant that he... was a Death Eater, like a real legit Death Eater, and that he was trying to, you know, take down Harry. And I remember after the first movie, my mum's going, no, he's a good guy. He's trying to protect Harry. And I just didn't believe her. And I got my comeuppance in the end, I guess.
Sit down, mother. He's a Death Eater.
I was like, I'm 7. I know what I'm talking about. I was sort of right, but I wasn't.
in the misdirection of the story, why you were kind of right, but... In the actual story, you weren't. I'm sorry.
You know what? J.K. Rowling, she was playing for a kid audience. I was a child. She did it right. She got me.
Well, that's what we'll say anyway. Is it Rowling? Rowling? How do you say Rowling?
In New Zealand, we say Rowling, but I don't know if we're particularly correct, seeing as she's British. So I'm going to take it that you're correct.
Well, I don't know how to say it, and I'm British.
I'm not going to change the way I say it, but... I'll accept defeat.
I don't know, because some people over here say J.K. Rowling, others say J.K. Rowling. So it's something I'm... which... Yes, you're right. This time you are right. You may not be 7 anymore, but you're definitely right about this then.
Well, I don't think I've heard many people in New Zealand say Rowling, but, yeah, we say a lot of things wrong. So.
But you do a lot of things right over there, including lamb. The introduction to Hogwarts, of course, when you first see the great school... that's a lovely moment. That's a brilliant moment as well. Yeah. I'm sure that gives you goosebumps.
Yeah, and the boats across the lake.
Yes.
It's such a great entrance. And my partner was going, but why do they make them go across in boats when everyone else can go across in carriages? I'm like, because look at this reveal. Like, imagine you're 11. You've just found out you can do magic and you're going away to a castle to learn it. I mean, and then you see this. Oh, unbelievable.
Some people just don't get cinematography, do they?
He doesn't get, like, books either. So.
He sounds like a nice guy, though.
Yeah.
Well, moving on from that revelation. Again, the sorting hat. I like the sorting hat. That cheeky little hat.
Oh, I love the Sorting Hat. Yeah. And we miss out on its songs in the movies, which I think is quite unfortunate because his songs are great.
Can you? Would you mind demonstrating one?
I'm about as good at singing as I am at Quidditch, but he does. He gives a good intro to all of the different houses, and I think it gives you a really good perspective on things as well, like how Gryffindor is for the brave and Slytherin is for the cunning and Ravenclaw is for the smart and Hufflepuff's for who knows what at that point. I don't think that they really explain it. They say loyal in the song, but you're like seven and you're going, what does that mean? But they don't really give you that in the book, I think. They don't really give you that really deeper understanding of the differences between the houses. From memory anyway.
It could be a missed opportunity maybe they just didn't have enough time. It's a long enough film as it is, but there's so much to actually, because you can imagine how much history is behind each house, which obviously in the expanded lore which has come since they've it's been given the backstory. But I like those kind of films where they mention these, in this case they mention these houses which are so old, and it kind of leaves you wondering, wow, how old, what's come before. And all that, and I love all that kind of stuff. And also, by the end of the fourth episode, we will make sure that Morgan sings a song from the Sorting Hats.
I would rather die. I would rather Avada Kedavra myself.
Well, we're still going to try, guys. They also didn't put Peeves the Poltergeist in.
Oh my gosh, I don't want to spend every episode lamenting over the fact that there's like countless things that they miss in the film. But Peeves the Poltergeist. I tried to explain it to my partner who hasn't really read the books. I'm trying to say, you know, Peeves.
Does he not like Poltergeist either now?
Yeah, like, I just think, that really grinds my gears. Oh, Potter, you rotter. He's great, yeah.
It's a nice rhyme, the nice one. Yeah, well, if that a bit more Peeves would have been brilliant. In fact, we may be a bit peeved off he's not in it, were he? Norbert the Dragon. Norbert was fun. I like Norbert. I'd like to give him a cuddle.
Yep, that one's good. I like that. They did change that storyline a bit, but it makes sense the way that they change it. And I think it's very, it sets you up for Hagrid sort of risking everything when it comes to fantastic beasts, I guess you could say. So,
yes. Yeah,
it's a good intro, and it's a good intro to Harry's other brothers as well, which is cool. Sorry, Harry's other brothers, Ron's. Harry's an orphan. He's got no family.
way to kick him when he's down.
He's rich and he's famous. He can take it.
Yeah, but nobody's ever asked how he was, though.
So. Yeah, that's true.
But, I mean, the film gets a bit more exciting, let's say, about two-thirds of the way through. It kind of moves from that sort of, like you say, charming fantasy world, and it becomes a bit more sort of your adventure film when you've got, especially as they're trying to get the Philosopher's Stone, or the Sorcerer's Stone, if you're from the United States. Never have understood that. But when you've got like the... when you mentioned when they fall into the trees.
Yeah.
All of that, apart from that horrendous acting. Can you do that one more time, the scream? the peril is real.
Hell yeah.
So you got that. Then obviously the keys attacking the key room. The chess, the game of chess. So you get that kind of very quick kind of three scenes together, which adds a bit of excitement for the kids out there.
Yeah, and it really sets them up for their different skill sets, I guess. Like you get Hermione through the the botanical one, the herbology one, at the beginning. But it would have been really cool I guess it's not very cinematic, but if they had done the potions quiz that they do just before going into the the place where the Mirror of Erised is, that would have been really cool. I think it really shows that there is flaws behind magic, and that the logic that we have as muggles can be helpful. Or maybe that's just me trying to justify not being a cool wizard. I don't know.
it sounds a bit like you're grasping somewhat there.
I could do that.
Maybe you still can. Same as Quidditch. Don't give up hope. Please. I guess you are right, because the chess game is obviously that's Ron's moment to shine. I guess even the key room. I mean, Harry sort of diverts them so Hermione and Ron can get out. And it would have been nice to have given her that chance to really shine a bit more, I think.
Yeah, and they didn't really give her that opportunity with the herbology one as well, because she's, you know, she's saying, oh, we'll just stop moving. But the really fantastic moment in the book where she's going, oh, we need light, but how could we get light? And Ron goes, are you a witch or not? I just love that so much. Like, just a great interaction. But I think she really could have done with that potions one at the end, yeah.
Yeah, I think it would have just helped flesh out her character more. I mean, she's got a good arc in the movie, but just little moments like that, and it also gives all three of them that moment to shine.
Yeah, and I was always a big Hermione fan because, you know, I was a young girl and I was like, oh, I love books. I'm basically Hermione.
Yeah, but you doubted that you could do the magic, so you fell short there.
I was 7, though. I was so sure that on my 11th birthday I had it coming.
I like the rationale. She likes books and she's a female.
Yeah, well,
I'm her.
But you grasp onto anything at that age. There weren't a lot of females in that book that I could grasp onto.
Yeah, you're right. But let's never forget, not that we ever could, but the books themselves were written by a female.
But did you, I don't know if you heard, but this is something that you hear as a girl as well, is she couldn't put her name as Joanne Rowling on the books because that sounds like it's written by a girl, therefore it's a girl's book. She was advised by her publisher to put her name down as J.K. Rowling so that she was more gender ambiguous and it would invite more boys to read the book.
That's just absolutely mental to hear that. Oh. It's so stupid to hear that.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know whether she consciously then made two of her main characters boys or whether that was just what she was going to do anyway. But
yeah,
I just find that quite interesting. But I mean,
would Stephen King's books be less successful if it was Stephanie King?
Yeah. I would like to do that. A name change would be nice.
I don't know. So I'm sitting there just mystified because those kind of things just still, and I know how much they grind your goat as well, but it just really winds me up to hear that kind of stuff because it's so unnecessary if you think about it, really.
Yeah, I mean, it would be interesting to see another life where she had written it as Joanne Rowling and see what kind of change it would have made, if any. So, yeah, I mean, it's baffling, but we'll never know, will we?
No, and in terms of the popularity of the books, I mean, I'm pretty sure that wasn't the reason why they became so huge, and I'd hate to think it had anything to do with it, of course, but
yeah,
I looked more like Harry when I was 11. I had the same bowl cut and the glasses and the sort, and I didn't have the scar on my head, but I generally did have the same haircut and glasses because I think my parents hated me a little bit.
Oh, no. Well, I didn't look like any of the characters. Probably looked like Hannah Abbott or Lavender Brown, probably.
Lavender Brown.
I was a backstory character. I was one of the people at the back who chimes up every now and then. Look at
me taking the lead character and you being very modest.
Like Harry. I was probably just as cool as him.
Yeah, back off. I was Potter, okay? Well, I appreciate your modesty and it's made me feel a bit silly. there's also a bit at the end of the film as well where Professor Quill, his turn is revealed, and quite literally a turn, because you realise that Lord Voldemort is attached to the back of his head, which for a kids film is, you know, I know it's a sort of a fantasy film, so there's always that kind of aspect to them, but it is quite a, don't want to use the word dark, but it is quite, like I say, it's quite scary for smaller eyes, I'd imagine,
for sure. I mean, it definitely gets darker as the next films go on, but that's and I think the scene in the forest where he's drinking from the unicorn's blood,
that's
quite haunting, because as children you're already scared of like dark forests, right? That's kind of creepy. And then there's this caped dude drinking from a unicorn. I mean, unicorns are, they're pure. Like, as kids you're like, yeah, unicorns, they're just like poop glitter and like they're so awesome. And then you see Voldemort like drinking from it from a dark forest and you're like,
Everything I ever thought was true was just being drunk
by
a bloke in a cloak
in
a forest. It's like every kid's nightmare.
Yeah.
As he feasted on that unicorn's glittery turd, now everything is gone to pot.
Yes.
There are those moments in the film which are, and in the next film, but in that film which, as an older person, it was nice to revisit and think, I'd forgotten about those scenes for some reason, and then obviously seeing him in there, because I've said earlier on that it worked as a kid's film, like a fun kid's film, but you forget as you watch it that there are those kind of scenes in it, which, are quite scary, I'd imagine, for kids, and they really do give that kind of fantastical element to it.
Yeah, and it really draws you in. I mean, I think that scene where Harry's saying, Voldemort's coming back tonight and I have to fight him and no, don't come with me. And he's doing his whole Harry Potter shtick, which we get very, very familiar with. I think that really adds a bit of gravity to it. You're really feeling like, oh gosh, this thing's real, and it's dangerous and Harry has to go through it and he's so young. And I think that's really apparent when you watch it when you're older. You're just thinking, gosh, that's a lot of weight to be on a child's shoulders, and he carries it so well. I think it's a very endearing moment, but God, I think it's quite scary, and you can imagine how he would have been feeling.
Yeah, that's how you have to imagine that. When I watch a horror film, the way I try to approach it is I try to pretend that I'm in the film. How would I react to seeing something like that come at me or whatever? So that's how I always try to.
Oh, yeah. I know I'd be horrible in situations. I know I'd be the kind of person to just freeze. I'd do like an ostrich and I'd stick my head in the sand and I'd be like, they can't see me.
That would be a strange visual just to have somebody just sticking their head, banging their head against the floor. Morgan, do you mind moving out of the way, Morgan? You're in the way of the door. I need to get out. Eat her, not me.
I'm the useless pawn where everyone can just run away because I'm lying. They're going, I don't want to be here.
or is it a masquerade? Are you really the queen of magic underneath it all?
Yeah. Well, hopefully. Yeah.
Yeah, there's still time. The 11th birthday may have passed, but there's still time, goddammit.
Lost? I've always heard that because around the time when I was born was when the big war was happening, and because Voldemort took over the Ministry of Magic and hit all the records of Muggleborns. So they're gonna get those records back and they're gonna find out that I actually am a wizard, yeah. I'm convinced.
I would like to be around when it happens in some way. If you wouldn't mind just picking up the Skype and just let me know, oh, by the way, I am actually...
You're a filthy muggle. I won't be associating with any of you.
You thought you were the lead character, Hudson. Get out of my way. Stick your head in the sand, boy. I guess it'd be loath to not say it. You've mentioned how much you love this film, and I can tell, actually, it's quite apparent how much you do love this movie. But, there's two sides to every coin. Was there anything about it which you didn't, I don't want to say didn't particularly like, but which didn't quite work as well for you, or you weren't as fond of?
Would have to be the first.
Was that scream again?
Yeah. Yeah, I would say probably that. And I think some of the lack of context that we get on things like the flaws that I have with this film aren't massive, but I would say that it's the things that we miss. Just the little stuff like explaining how the house points work. They only mention it briefly and you don't really get to see the hourglasses in any of the films, really. They're sort of tucked away in the back, and the lack of Peeves. And I think that we could have maybe gotten a little bit closer to Ron's family. All the family that's in the common room, I feel like they have such a great rapport, obviously. And I think Harry really finds himself an actual family there in that year. So we get a little bit of that, but I would have loved a whole film on that, really.
I've mentioned some of the acting is from the young kids, which, again, it may sound like heresy, but some of it just isn't good. Mm. And yes, that is, let's not lie about it. This is their first film. I think Daniel Radcliffe had a role in a British TV series, but only a very minor one.
Yeah.
Emma Watson was, again, this is her first role. Rupert Grint was literally just did school plays and that was it. So that's why some of the acting is off, because they weren't necessarily trained actors, child actors. So on the one side, they actually did very well, but there are times when it is quite clunky, like you mentioned. As is some of the editing is a bit clunky as well sometimes. I found that actually in a few of the films, and in the one we're going to talk about next, some of the editing is quite strange. It kind of jumps from scene to scene, and it's quite jarring at times.
Yeah. I think that it's quite interesting that they chose those actors, though, because you wonder... I mean, I think that they were, in the end, the perfect fit, and so I'm sure
the
casting directors saw something that we didn't. But you have to wonder what the other people auditioning for the role were like, if... You know, I sounds very rude, but if we ended up with these three who were quite fresh to acting, you know, surely there were other kids who had a little bit more experience who were auditioning for it.
Yeah, I think the casting director of this film just left because Chris Columbus was so, firstly, because he was so insistent on having Daniel Radcliffe in the lead role that they auditioned, you know, thousands of kids and... You know, he declined all of them, saying, no, none of them have got what I need.
Yeah.
And she becomes so exasperated, which she pretty much just, fine, you do it. Yeah, it's interesting to see what they were looking for, because Rupert Grint sent a video of him rapping to get their attention, and that's how we got an audition.
That's the wrong thing to do, honestly.
Exactly, it's the most ridiculous thing, but somehow it worked, because he got in front of them and got the gig. I know what you mean, though, because either some of the kid actors must have been absolute arse, or they were just definitely, or these three just had that spark. Mm. And I guess they must have been in the same room together at one point to know that.
It was because they were so much like their characters, though. You know, you could look at Rupert Grint and go, okay, he's quite fresh to acting, but he's so Ron that, you know, he's just going to be able to figure it out. And if he's not that good at acting, that's fine because we can get him acting classes and he'll pick it up along the way. Maybe that's what they were looking for. They were just looking for that. You know, they got their Hermione bang on, so I think that maybe that's what they were looking for. Harry's a hard to find, though.
That was the tough one, I can only imagine, because it would be all well and good having a great Ron and a great Hermione, but if the title character wasn't performed or portrayed well, it could have really bombed. But did they get lucky or what? But whatever they did, they hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, and I think it's all easy to say, oh, we're looking for someone who's obsessed with books and cleverness, and we're looking for someone who's hungry and funny and comic relief. But how do you find someone who's brave and loyal? Like, how do you ask an 11-year-old? Like, and what would you do?
Yeah, if you saw this guy coming out of the back of his head, what would you do? But it's true, though. It's really, that is a fantastic point, because... I guess I've never been to an acting class, so I wouldn't know, but I'm assuming they teach you how to emote to certain situations. And if you haven't had any kind of real formal training and you're being asked to kind of react to, firstly, some things which aren't actually there, because then obviously there's a green screen and CGI, but also just situations which you probably never have imagined in your wildest dreams.
Yeah.
So it is actually a really good point, is how the fact they managed to elicit any kind of response.
Yeah. And I guess they did know that they could put them in acting classes, the best acting classes in the world.
Yeah.
So they probably knew what they were doing. I trust them.
Yep, and it paid off because it's a good film. I enjoyed the film. It had a nice, kind of carefree start, and it obviously picked up and got a bit, you started to see the direction the actual franchise was going to take by the end. And I like the fact that they teased Voldemort, He Who Shall Not Be Named, really early on, you know what I mean? They set their stall out and like, this, there is like an evil presence hanging over this film.
Yeah.
But we're only going to hint and poke at it. And yes, they showed it at the end, but they don't really give too much away, and it really does build up the intrigue for what's to come.
Yeah. And he's such a great villain, I think. So probably a lot of pressure on their end to get that right.
Yeah. But I guess this is going to be the most foolish question I've ever asked anybody, but I'm going to ask it. The Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, did you like it?
I love it.
After all that.
I love it.
Actually, what might be quite fun to do and quite challenging, but I think I may already have your answer ready, is on the final episode, we are going to rank all of the films in order of...
Gosh.
from eight to one. What do we think is our least favourite to our number one? So that's in the final episode. So tune in a couple of weeks, month's time to find that out. I think that's pretty much covered the Philosopher's Stone. We've found out that obviously this is a film which you know, Morgan grew up with and she's got a great affinity for. I enjoyed the film. It wasn't without its flaws for me, but I enjoyed it, and I'm not stupid enough to think that there weren't circumstances behind some of those flaws. So that's part one, covered in an invisibility cloak. So, Professor McGregor, what is next?
A Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, of course.
It's been 50 years since the chamber was opened. The last time the Chamber of Secrets was opened, a mudblood died.
I'm Harry, sir. Harry Potter.
Good Lord. Are you really? Well, Ron's told us all about you, of course.
Brachium. Emendo!
Oh. Dobby, please, no.
Harry Potter must say he's not going back to school.
Riddle!
Professor Dumbledore.
I was just sitting in the yew bend thinking about death.
Let me rip you. Let me kill you.
You filthy little mudblood.
Strange. I've never seen spiders act like that.
I don't like spiders.
Your scar is legend. As, of course, is the wizard who gave it to you.
Hermione, come out. We've got loads to tell you.
Go away. Wait till you see. It's awful.
Expelliarmus!
I'm going to have to turn you in, Hagrid. I don't think you meant it to kill anyone, but...
You can't. You don't understand.
You'll be next, mudbloods.
The Chamber of Secrets has been opened. Enemies of the air, beware. It's written in blood.
And in the meantime, I strongly recommend caution to all.
So, number two, first thing I will say about this film is the acting is a lot better.
Oh yeah, they spent the summer going to Muggle acting classes, I imagine.
Muggle acting classes. So that tickled me somewhat. That's the first thing I looked out for, was do they get better? And from the first scenes, you can see it, that they, all three of them, have just become a lot more confident, a lot more assured and more mature, especially Daniel Radcliffe in some of his scenes, certainly later on in the movie. You can tell that he's been studying the craft.
Oh, yeah. And I think one that we didn't mention in the first movie, unfortunately, but Tom Felton, Draco Malfoy, he really sucked up his name in this film as well. I think that he was quite a good actor, actually, in the first movie. He did quite well with his role. But in the second one, he really comes into his own. And I love the Draco character. I have a little bit of an affinity to him. So it's great to see him.
Do you fancy Draco Malfoy?
I think, actually, when I was younger and I was around their age, I think I was a bit of a Draco fan. I think I was.
Maybe that was your secret addiction. You were mad for Malfoy.
I don't think he was ever my favourite character, but I always did appreciate him. I love a bit of a tortured soul, so...
Just rewinding back to the first film, he did have that kind of, like, snotty little sod down to a T, didn't he?
Yes.
It's not just the bleach slick back hair, but it was just something about him which you thought...
He's another Dudley, basically.
Yes, exactly. Put the word out of my mouth.
Yeah, he's Dudley, and it's great to see what Dudley would have turned out like if he was a wizard. But, and he's so quotable as well, you know, my father's going to hear about this. I mean, everyone knows that quote. It's great. I love it. And I think that, yeah, Draco's a fantastic character to follow throughout the films, because he's sort of a mirror image of Harry. If Harry,
yes, you're right,
different circumstances, I think. And it's the two sides of the coin. They always say that Gryffindor and Slytherin are two sides of the same coin. And I think that Harry and Draco are really, really good representations of that, how similar they are. Yeah,
sorry for all the Potterheads out there that I completely forgot to mention Draco Malfoy in the first film, but it's also just good writing having the protagonist have another character who's literally his opposite. It's just good writing. It gives you somebody to play off immediately, and it's something which in this film the Chamber of Secrets, you know, gets deeper and deeper, the rivalry between them.
And it's kind of good to have that balance from Voldemort, who's a really scary, murderous, unforgivable.
Almost immortal villain, yeah.
Yeah, and he's unforgivable. But Draco, he's just a boy, and he's had, you know, bad... Well, I mean, Tom Riddle had bad circumstances, but Draco is kind of rough. But
I think Tom Riddle had better weeks and better days.
Yes, but I think that it does show you that with the right companionship and the right guidance, you can get out of those bad spaces. And it does give that balance of, you know, you've got a really, really terrifying villain, but then you've got sort of one that's not, you know, it's not that bad. It's sort of just good writing to have a villain that, you know, can't do serious damage like murder yet.
Well, he probably could if he tried, yeah. He also debuted the term filthy little mudblood as well.
Oh my gosh, just a cheeky bit of racism there.
Yeah.
Potter in the Chamber of Secrets.
Casual racism by the whitest bloke in the film.
Literally probably a skinhead.
He became what Radcliffe did in later life in that film, Imperium. You filthy racist Malfoy. It's another quote which I've heard so much since 2002, I think this film came out. In those 16 years... That particular line I've heard so many people say, even if I was in school or college, just like in the background of like the cafeteria, you just hear someone say, "Oh, you filthy mudblood." It's just really strange to hear, but that one's lived on as well.
Yeah, he had such great quotes, I think. Training for the ballet, Potter? Great.
Yes, that's a fantastic British accent. Harry Potter.
I doubt it.
It's better than mine, and I'm from the bloody country. But I mean, this film made a lot of money as well. It made a little bit less than the first film, but we're talking about, you know, we're talking like $48 million less. So, you know, one day's gross worth than the film. So it made about $900 million almost. So the two films combined had made almost nearly $2 billion. So in layman's terms, a lot of people went to see them, basically.
Yeah, that's unfathomable, that amount of money.
It is, and I mean... Again, if you adjust that for inflation, I mean, they both made well over $1 billion in today's terms, today's money, which is incredible. And again, going back to the fact that they have three young kids leading this franchise and they're pulling in numbers that much, yet they managed to keep their feet on the ground by the looks of it, or then anyway, is testament to the temperament of the three kids.
They did amazing. I think that, I mean, imagine that level of pressure. I couldn't imagine that even at my own age right now.
I struggle to multitask in the kitchen, let alone carry a $2 billion franchise on my shoulders with all of the fans, rabid fans, because this is no different than the Marvel, DC fans, Star Wars, Lord of the Rings fans. The fans for this will suck your blood dry to get the last book on the shelf. They love this franchise, and for good reason too.
And I think that I kind of am thankful that there wasn't social media around at that time. And I'm a big advocate for using social media properly. But like when I watch how people interact with the Stranger Things, I keep going back to them because I think that they're a really good, I guess, example of it, even if the franchise isn't quite as big. But I think the way that people talk and interact with these people on social media, these kids, kind of terrifying. And a lot of it isn't actually other adults. It's other kids their own age who understandably but regrettably don't really know how to appropriately talk to someone who is famous. And I think that that's quite terrifying because imagine the level of pressure that you would have at 11 or 12 and carrying that massive franchise. I mean,
you'd grow a thick skin very quickly, I'd imagine.
I mean, you'd go nuts. You'd do a full...
Well, you would do, yeah.
Even Britney Spears, I think. I would.
You'd end up shaving your head and hitting cars with an umbrella.
Yeah, that's my plan. That's my escape plan for almost anything.
If I ever see on social media you wearing that coat with a bald head, I know what's coming. I know what's coming. I'm logging off. So it might be quite fun to get you on the show during those times.
Yeah, I think so. I'd be an interesting person to talk to.
Well, you already are, so...
Thank you. I don't need to shake my head.
Yeah. Just don't go mental either. Everything's fine. You will become that wizard. You will become the new Hermione. It's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. I have full faith, maybe.
Once all these episodes are done and you've got your Potterisms off your chest, then that's when it will happen.
Oh, I'm looking forward to it then. That'll be great. Yeah. full fruition.
I forgot actually. Within 10 minutes of this film, that you meet that charming little git Dobby, the house elf, everybody's favourite little elf.
Oh my god, he stressed me out so much as a kid, like really genuinely stressed me out because
I can feel it.
I'm like rubbing my eyes right now. I feel like I'm getting a attention migraine or something. It's just, I hate those moments in films and books where, you know exactly what's going to happen if, you know, for instance, Dobby drops the cake on the, on the guest at the Dursleys. You just know how bad it's going to be for Harry. You know that they're going to think it's Harry. You know it's not his fault and he's doing everything he can to stop it. And I hate those moments. I was not a Dobby fan when he first came on the scene. Not until the fourth book was I a fan of Dobby. He just frustrated me to no end.
Good. I it would break my heart to think of you rubbing your hands at glee at his final performance.
Oh my god, but no. His...
Okay, good.
No. I took two deaths at the last book, the hardest, and his was definitely one of them.
yeah, it was. It was a shocking one.
Oh.
In terms of this film, yeah, he's a cheeky rascal, dropping that cake on his head, and then he just disappears like an absolute coward.
Yeah, and I think I do feel like I do now as well, but I did back then. I felt quite sorry for him because you see him self-harming and you know that it's bad.
That's quite brutal, those scenes as well, isn't it? Because he literally is just damaging himself.
It's heartbreaking, but I just hate those kind of... So I couldn't stand it. I could not.
So was Dobby at this time, was he on the same level of hatred that you have for Blade Runner?
Oh my god. No, that's still a different level entirely.
Okay, well, if you haven't heard it, go back and listen to the episode. You can just listen to Morgan spit acid on the Blade Runner franchise. Ryan Gosling's beard.
I hate Blade Runner with a deep passion, but Dobby, it was more of a frustration, I think. You know, I knew what he was trying to do, but I just couldn't stand his means. His means did not justify the end, I think. But he was misguided. He wasn't just purposefully crap.
Yes, and when he was beating himself senseless in Harry's room,
it
was sort of quite awkwardly uncomfortable to watch. And then obviously later on he irons his hands as as self-punishment. You think, bloody hell, just have a cup of tea, calm down. Again, this film was very similar to The Philosopher's Stone in that it starts quickly and it gets to the point very quickly. It doesn't spend half an hour slowly drudging through what's been happening in the time he's been away from Hogwarts and back with the Dursleys. It is back in the house, the Uncle Dursley, he's entertaining the guests. He goes upstairs, there's Dobby, drops a cake on the head, Ron comes in a flying car, saves him, and we're off.
I love it. I love that it goes so quickly. And I think it's quite similar to me with the first film. I think that the pace is really brilliant. And I think that it still does have that childish charm. It does get a lot darker than the first film, but it does sort of start out in a nice place. You're like, oh, there's this like wacky house elf, and it's like trying to stop him from going to Hogwarts. And you kind of think, oh,
look, he's so farming. what a cad.
But, you know, it's quite, it feels like the stakes aren't high again. You know, you feel like you're at the start of the Philosopher's Stone where you're like, oh, yeah, there's like a bad guy. We know that.
It still feels fun.
The worst thing that could happen is that he couldn't go to Hogwarts, you know, that's what you think. And it does sort of, it's not quite as Christmassy as the first one, but I think I'd still enjoy watching it on Christmas Eve. So.
Yeah, they've all got that lovely quality to them. And again, that comes from John Williams' score as well, because I've heard criticism of John Williams' particular score, basically by saying it doesn't evoke enough kind of fantasy feeling. And I'm not sure if these people are just tone deaf or just bloody stupid.
Any time I hear Hedwig's theme song, I drop everything I am doing. I'm suddenly wearing my Gryffindor scarf and my glasses and my wand, and I'm just ready to go. Like, it takes me there immediately. I think it's perfect. I will fight anyone who dares say anything bad about it.
I don't doubt you will either, Cross. But it's another one of his scores, because I love John Williams, not just for what he did on the Star Wars films, but Jurassic Park, the Harry Potter, the Home Alone franchise, which is some of the music, and that sounds similar to these because they've got that really nice sort of festive seasonal feel to them. But yeah, Hedwig's theme, John Williams wrote that, and it only became the main theme because he basically said, well, everybody seemed to like it, so yeah. I thought we'd go with it. So he obviously didn't realise that he'd made another iconic score. But yeah, I know what you mean. When you hear that, it just transports you straight to the great halls of Hogwarts.
It's really beautiful. And I think that, you know, he did write basically the soundtrack to my childhood, but what with like Star Wars and Jurassic Park and everything. But
yeah.
I mean, it really is magical because it's sort of, you know, it's jingly. I don't know anything about music, clearly, but it's quite jingly and fun, and it has its low points and everything, but you sort of feel magical. I feel like it feels magical. I feel like glitter was coming out of his hands while he was, you know, creating that song.
As long as he wasn't pooping it, it's okay.
He's not a unicorn. He's just a...
You don't know where that wand really lives, his composing stick. I'm sure it's got... I'm not a musician either, so it's probably got a proper name, not just composer's stick. But you're right, though. There is a real, real nice seasonal feel to it, and it has got that sort of jingle-jangle feeling to it.
Mm.
And it is that kind of like childlike quality to it, which kind of transports you back to a nicer... or transports you away to a nicer place, if I could say so.
And you can tell why they didn't, you know, use it quite so much in the later movies, mm-hmm. because it is quite a happy song, you know, and those films didn't really justify having a happy song at the beginning because you're like,
having smiles in it, yeah.
In a pretty bleak place, so.
Yeah, it probably just jarred the tone somewhat having that playing over some of the scenes that later on.
The Star Wars theme song, da-da-da-da, and you're like, yeah, okay, we're beginning. Voldemort's here.
Yeah, Voldemort's here and he's pissed off, but let's just play this really happy song over the top of it. Probably would have derailed those films somewhat, but
a little bit.
I like the scene of Harry and Ron they don't get through. We didn't even mention platform 9 3/4, which is one of the most mental things about the film. And at King's Cross Station in London, they have the plaque for
platform 9 3/4. It's going to be the first place I go, truly.
Yeah, it's there, and you wonder how many people have tried running through that wall. There's one of them I'm speaking to now. I'd imagine going to give it a go.
I'm just thinking, I definitely would.
It will be in the metro over here. News: Kiwi unconscious after trying to fling through wall.
Shaves her head and beats people with an umbrella afterwards.
Screaming magical spells at people.
Yeah. Accio umbrella. So.
She's currently being detained for questioning. I've got this as evidence now, so yeah. I'm off the hook.
Now I can't do it. It's too clear that I've planned this all out.
Yeah, sorry for ruining your fun. Yeah, so they can't make it through the wall, obviously, to the Hogwarts Express, which is an awesome looking train. That's fine, but so they get in the car and they go chasing after the train. And I like that scene because it's another one of those really cool adventure scenes, fun adventure-y time moments where they're chasing after the train. And of course, it's not going to be simple. So that was one of the things straight from the bat, which I enjoyed.
Yeah, I loved it. I think that. It does show how dumb Harry and Ron are when they're together, though. You know, like, that crap wouldn't have happened if Hermione was there. She would have been like, oh, I'm just going to wait for people to come out. It's going to be fine. Like, just chill out.
Let these two idiots knock themselves out. you're right. She's the glue.
Yeah. I just try and think of all the things that wouldn't have happened if Hermione had been there at every moment. But
It'd probably only been one book long.
Yeah, and then Voldemort was taken down by an 11-year-old girl. Yeah, I do love that scene, though, and I think it's great. I think it's really awesome as well to see that mesh of Muggle technology with, you know, all the rest of the wizard stuff, because I think that we only get that every now and then. Everything feels quite old-timey. You don't get that, you know, what would happen if Wi-Fi was created by wizards, or if wizards hijacked
Wizard-fi.
Yeah, like what if they hijacked television? You don't get that, but you see what they do if
they
do try and work with sort of newer technology, which is this fun flying car.
Yeah, and I like how when it makes the paper, the McGonagall and Snape are so pissed off, you can tell that actually that was a bad mistake. And again, it just kind of starts to slowly build layers of well, you know, these muggles, they're not exposed to this, and you know, do you know what you've done? It kind of starts building up that intrigue very quickly. Again, something else I appreciated very quickly in the film.
And I think that was probably, I have to think that was the first book that I read before the movies. And I remember that scene where McGonagall and Snape are sort of telling them off for it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, they're going to be sent home. Harry's never going to do magic again. Like, completely was not paying attention to the amount of book that was left that sure go home, which now that I'm older, I know these things.
Yeah, but you know, that the extra 400 pages must mean something.
Yeah, yeah. We're just going to see Harry moping around or something. But
Harry Potter and the emo stage.
Yeah, but you start to get a real feeling for how much you as the audience as well depend on Hogwarts, you know. You want to be there just as much as Harry does, and the threat of having to go home because he stupidly drove a car.
Yes, an underage boy foolishly drove a car. What was he?
Boys will be boys or whatever, right? We don't get that as girls. As girls, we're not told that we can just drive off in flying cars. We would be doing...
We don't get that in the UK, but it must be a New Zealand thing.
Yeah.
Even though it happened in good old Blighty, but yeah, I like that. And if you read this book first, then obviously you're going into the film with a different mindset, different appreciation. How was that compared to the first film?
Well, I mean, like I said, I was very young, so I don't remember everything too clearly, but I do remember.
Why not?
Yeah, having that sense of actually being able to compare the book with the movie, which I didn't have with the first one, and. Yeah. It was a good place to start because it wasn't like the fourth or the sixth movie where, you know, I was sitting there fuming about all the things that were missing. Although as an 8 or 9 year old, I'm not sure whether I would have. But I think that it was quite interesting to watch the comparisons and also have a face for Dobby because he's quite a difficult character to conjure up in your mind when you've never seen him before.
What does a house elf look like?
Yeah, I don't think I came up with anything convincing in my head.
Did it look anything? You may not remember. Do you think it looked anything like what you saw on screen?
I don't remember, but I imagine no.
Probably just looked like a very ugly small man.
I think I have the habit of not actually picturing faces when I don't have anything to go from because it just stresses me out too much. I just go, I can't do this. We're just doing a faceless thing right now.
Doesn't take much to stress you out. Clearly,
I do sound like a very stressed person.
Yeah, just if it takes the fact that you just have to imagine what somebody looks like to really set you off, then I'd hate to see you in a panic.
Yeah.
This'd be like a drinking game. What's going to set her off? Hopefully nothing. Hopefully not these podcast episodes.
Yes.
you mentioned the six great British actors, which I'm going to refer to. Another one is in this film, and he's clearly having a bloody good time, as Gilderoy Lockhart is Kenneth Branagh. You can just tell he's having so much fun in his role.
That was another jarring scenario for me when I found out what he's actually known for. Because with Snape, I mean, I was so young, I don't know these people. I was like, Alan Rickman who? So when I found out he plays this villain and everything else, and he's got short hair and he's sort of a little bit older than I imagined Snape would be, that was very jarring. But when I found out that Kenneth does Shakespeare, I was like,
yeah.
Lockhart's a moron. How is he going to do Shakespeare? Like, I just couldn't fathom it at all that he was this genius guy.
Have you managed to get your head around it since?
Oh, yes.
Good.
the Shakespeare fan that I am.
Are you a Shakespeare fan?
Oh, yeah, for sure. We have in New Zealand, or in Auckland, we have this thing called the Pop-Up Globe, which doesn't really
pop
up anymore. It's more of a permanent installment where they do different Shakespeare every summer. It's the highlight of my year every year because I don't have a new Harry Potter book to look out for. So
it does sound quite cool, actually, to be fair.
It's great. We love Shakespeare for people who aren't in England.
I'd love to hear the bard's work in a New Zealand accent. I think that'd be quite interesting.
It's hilarious sometimes because we put our own spin on it sometimes. You should have heard the uproar. There was Midsummer Night's Dream, I think it was. I've not actually seen or read that one. But I think it's the one with the fairies. And we had the fairies talk in Te Reo, which is our native language.
Yep.
The uproar. They're ruining the Shakespeare. They're ruining Shakespeare. We can't understand what they're saying. I'm like, hun, you can't understand what Shakespeare is saying half the time anyway.
No, I can't understand what he's on about.
Like, so we're probably better off hearing it in Tadeo. It's a bit more, recent for us here.
I thought it would have been more appreciated translating it into the native tongue.
No, we're, we're a bit of a racist.
To be or not to be. That was my attempt. I'm never going to do it again. So, now, moving on very quickly from my crap Kiwi accent, because I've just offended the whole country. Fellow Commonwealthers. Because I'm not going to forget the mouth voice this time. Jason Isaacs is, again, like Snape, he's got this sort of like smarmy, charming menace to him as Lucius Malfoy. And the two of them, Lucius and Draco, are so well matched by their actors.
They really are. I love his character. And I think that, I was never one to really appreciate villains. I'm very black and white, you know. I'm like, he's the bad guy. But
I don't like bad guy.
Yeah, I'm like, he's mean to my friend Harry. but as I get older, the more I can appreciate, I guess, the role that he took. Because just like Draco is sort of a balance for Harry, the two sides, the two coins. You then get Lucius and Ron's dad, whose name I forgot, Arthur. Yeah, you get the two of them sort of balancing each other out. With, you know, racist person versus someone who's obsessed with, you know, muggles. So it's quite a good, and, you know, rich and poor and big family man and, like, you know, the rest of it. So, yeah.
It is a very black and white comparison because, like you just said, rich man, poor man, one doesn't like a certain type of people, one, you know, actively, you know, works and is amongst them. So it is, like, very straight down the middle. There's no, you know, blurring of the lines, but it works. And sometimes that kind of, you know, dare I say, simple kind of way of storytelling is the most effective.
Yeah, and I think as kids as well, I mean, I think this with adults too, but I think that black and white storytelling, especially when you're talking about things like classism and racism and stuff, are really great because, you know, it doesn't leave much room for misinterpretation for people who might think differently. You know, you can't sit there and go, oh, well, Lucius hates muggles because obviously muggles are like crap and dumb. And, like, you know, you can't do that. You can't sit there and like justify his racism. And just like you can't justify that, you know, rich people are better parents or whatever, because you get that really clear black and white good guy, bad guy, which I don't think makes for very intelligent story writing, but I'm convinced that the average viewer isn't a very intelligent interpreter, myself included. So I don't think that we need to, I do think that we need that hand holding. Yeah.
That is Morgan's sweeping statement of the week. Everybody is unintelligent.
Yeah. Well, you know what? I stand by.
I know what you mean. No, it works though in like you say, in this kind of storytelling, it needs that. I mean, there's no point to trying to justify why Lucius is a bastard, because it works better the fact that he just is.
Yeah.
He has his way of thinking, because let's face it, there are people out there who have backwards way of thinking, and there are people out there who have their own different ways of thinking which are completely opposite. You don't need to justify it. Some people are just bad people, like the Malfoys, or how they are. It's Lucius Malfoy in this film, you know.
Yeah.
He's portrayed as this way, and it works because of that. There's no point trying to make him sympathetic.
Yeah, and I think that we get, you know, as we go along with the other movies and the other books, we get that depth with Draco, which I think is really good to give him that depth as opposed to Lucius. You don't really get, you know, his backstory or anything. But with Draco, you do get it. And I think that that's better because you do get that perspective of, well, children are quite innocent and he's been brought up a certain way. His circumstances have sort of shaped him just the same way that Tom Riddle's and Harry Potter's and everyone else's has shaped them to be who they are. But with the right sort of companionship and guidance, you can change that. And I think that giving Malfoy the chance as opposed to Lucius, a grown man who has no excuse, is a much better way to approach the conversation of, you know, whether or not you can change your mind about being, you know, racist or whatever. Yeah.
One's set in their ways and the other one is still young enough to, you know, learn, essentially.
Yeah, and sort of a victim of their circumstances as well. And you do quite to feel for Draco later on, and his mum too sometimes. So it's a good balance between, you know, the black and white, good and bad Arthur and Lucius, and then the sort of you've got a chance to become the person you're going to be, Draco Harry sort of mirror.
Yeah, and this is my sweeping statement of the week, but nobody's born bad. Nobody's born a racist or a psycho killer or anything or whatever it may be. You inherit it from your surroundings or the people you're around or, yeah, like you say, you're a victim of circumstance. So that plays out very well.
Just like Tom Riddle.
Just like Tom Riddle, exactly. And it works for these stories. Sometimes you don't need to convolute the water anymore. But in terms of that kind of progression in the story, as Harry gets older, because he is a year older in this film I found was, here comes the D word, but not that D word, but it's darker than the original, I think.
Yeah. And they do keep getting darker, don't they? But it is. I mean, even the whole snake thing and, the actual Chamber of Secrets, not just the whole book. The actual it's terrifying. Like, it's such a creepy thing to have this giant monster slithering through the walls and living underneath everyone. And you know, if it looks at you, you die. Like, that's just, I mean, that's terrifying. And it is so much
Greek mythology level stuff, though.
Yeah, and I mean, Harry gets ostracized again by his... I mean, you don't really get that much in the first movie as opposed to the book, but he does get ostracized by people because they misunderstand him and their association with snakes and stuff, so...
And the heir of Slytherin, yes.
Yeah, so it gets very dark, and you do meet Voldemort in quite a different scenario than you did in the other.
Yes. Well, let's not forget that the original Chamber of Secrets message was written in a cat's blood, which was hanging, so...
Haunting.
The way they're like, and I think it's Hermione said, it's written in blood. I can't do her voice. And then the camera pans and you see Mrs. Norris, the cat, just swinging and hanging. And I thought, I'm going to catch whoever's done that.
That was so morbid, having a message written in blood.
And then showing where the blood came from, an animal hanging.
Mm. And I think that reading that as well as reading it before watching the movie for the first time, that was terrifying, actually having to read it, I think, because you're so sucked into the scene that it's sort of, you just feel it happening to you at the same time. And as a young kid, oh my gosh, someone writing with blood, I don't like that. I don't like that now.
Had to put the book down and have a glass of water.
Yeah.
I've never been a fan of anything being written in blood, so I'm glad we're on the same wavelength there.
I don't want to meet the person who says the opposite.
Stay far away, please.
Yeah.
But there are some darker moments. I mean, I don't like spiders. In fact, I hate spiders, so I'm on the right hemisphere in that case. But I hate spiders. And then, of course, in this one, you get a bloody massive one, Aragog.
Yeah. Aragog that was terrifying as well. I've never really had a problem with spiders, but just that feeling of being trapped and all of them closing in on them. Not a fan.
No, I don't like snakes either. I don't like snakes or spiders, so really, this film isn't for me. Yeah, exactly. You get the snake in the first half, and then the sodding massive spiders, and then the little ones later on. But that was, again, I'm thinking from a child's perspective, like a 12, 13-year-old, that could be quite creepy and freaky as well.
Yeah, and I think that... What I always noticed about the books and the movies is how you don't get that with the first movie. You sort of get the golden trio going at it together. You know, they're going down into the dungeon together and they're doing all this together. And then after that, you almost get sort of a swapping, you know. Second book, Hermione can't fight with them, so it's a Ron storyline. And then third book, you know, Ron can't walk, so it's a Hermione storyline. And it sort of flip-flops. And it is very interesting that the year that Ron has to really pull weight is the year with all the spiders. So that was very, very interesting to me.
That's a very good point. And certainly the books, like you mentioned, everybody is given a bit more to do and have more centric stories, character centric stories, which is an interesting point to bring up, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess it makes it easier as well. Because it means that you get sorry, you get to know the characters a lot more because you get to focus on them. And it is unfortunate that, you know, Hermione's petrified, but it does really
It is unfortunate that happens, yes.
A little bit unfortunate. But it is good to see Ron actually, you know, step up, because you do kind of know Hermione at that point as the smart one. And, you know, you just know that if she was there all the time, like, it would be solved instantly. So to have...
It's an important moment.
Himself, as an actually very helpful companion is great.
I imagine that almost scarred you for life, seeing yourself on screen, primarily, petrified.
Truly shocking, but I always knew I was going to be a star, so...
Yeah, plus there was a lot more books afterwards, which I thought she may make it out of this film.
Yeah, except she's a lot braver than me, so...
But again, you never, ever know...
And I don't know if I want to know. I don't want to be put in a life-threatening situation.
It's just, actually, put it when you put it like that. Let's just stick to the sort of happy-go-lucky, carefree lives we live.
Yes.
Nothing worse than that, please. Let's just have milkshakes and wear cool coats and watch Harry Potter.
Basically, that'd be the life.
Sounds so right, to be fair, as long as I get paid for it. I mentioned that we had a moment in this film, I mentioned it earlier on, where the two Titan actors go at it, which they do. And it's a very short duel between Alan Rickman as Snape and Kenneth Branagh as Gilderoy Lockhart. And they have that very quick duel of wands. Just to see those two have a little moment to act together was wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I never really understood why it was included. I know that's a really interesting thing to say because it's such a great scene, but because there's all these scenes that are left out, I do wonder, other than the expose of Expelliarmus and then getting Harry up on stage to, talk to a snake.
Talk to the snake, yeah.
It's quite an interesting scene. I guess that they thought, you know, we've got these two amazing actors. There really is a scene in the book where they go
need them
and fight it out, and they're sort of a bit weird at it. So I guess, you can't really get the opportunity, but we don't get things like, what's his name, Sir Nicholas's death day party like you do in the book.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of wonder where they did that way up, I guess.
Would it have fit in this film as it was, do you think, that particular scene you mentioned?
The death day party?
Yeah, do you think they could have fit it in and kept it within the context of the film?
I wonder if it would have been hard to do it, but I think it would have been great to show at least like a small scene of the kids there. I don't think that they needed the full thing, because I've always felt like it's not, you know, a super important storyline, but you get that sort of Moaning Myrtle moment where they really connect with her and they meet her, and then you also get you know that connection with what the ghosts know about the about the castle. So I think that's really important as well. But I think that, I mean, just a little bit of it would have been great.
I can tell that you were desperate for that scene.
I think it was quite a quintessentially Harry moment, you know, him promising to help someone out and then realizing that it's on the night of Halloween and he's going to miss the big feast and they're not even going to have like food that humans can eat there and all the rest of it. And still going, you know, and taking his friends along with, because he'd made a promise and he's Harry Potter and he's not going
to
go back.
He sticks to his promise.
Yeah. And I think that's a good moment for Harry. And I think it's a good moment for the reader or the viewer, because, you know, you're thinking, God, I wouldn't go to that. Or at least I was. I was thinking about the feast and how I wanted to go to the feast, and Harry wasn't going, and he's having a crap time at the death day party, but he still went and he's still helping out Sir Nicholas, because even later on in the book, referring to that scene, because he sees how Sir Nicholas is treated by his peers and he sees how hard it is for Sir Nicholas to be a ghost, which I think is very, very Harry moment, in my opinion.
Yeah, when you spell it out quite so eloquently as that, it does kind of make you think that could have played a part as a character building exercise.
Yeah.
It could have helped, and visually, it you know, how they would have created it, but I'm sure they could have made it work.
And it could have looked really cool, actually, if they'd done it. It could have been a fantastic scene. And I don't think it needed to be long, but I don't think either, on the other hand, that it needed to replace the dueling one. I've just always found it an odd mix-up of which scenes you take and which ones you let go.
Yeah, I guess it was just in there to show that, firstly, Snape isn't messing around. This is what he can do, and And obviously Lockhart is this supremely confident, arrogant, always peddling his own material kind of guy.
Yeah.
And he just gets, you know, taken down straight away and made to look like a fool. So it kind of shows, you know, that Snape knows what he's doing.
And it is a powerhouse scene because they're both such amazing actors. So
yeah, and that may have come into it as well. The fact that when you get having these two on screen at the same time is just a privilege to see. And who knows? I don't know what almost on set. Maybe they did think we'll keep that in just because those two just sell that 1 minute and 30 seconds, whatever it is, when they're talking and then the duel. I don't know, maybe.
It's such a great scene, though, I think. And it is just funny watching. You do want to watch Gilderoy taken down. And I think all of the scenes that we missed out on in the movie where the other teachers are taking the piss out of Gilderoy, you only get a few of them. So I think that one's probably a great one to watch Gilderoy sort of get taken down a notch. Hopefully.
Exactly. Maybe that is why it's in there, just to show that as a message to children that don't be so cocksure about yourselves because, you know, there's always somebody who will knock you down.
Yeah.
Or is that too mean?
No, I think it's probably about right.
Good. Excellent. You mentioned Moaning Myrtle as well. I thought she was a fun character. She actually had one of my favourite quotes of the entire saga when she mentions that she was just sitting in the U-bend thinking about death. I was like, that's fantastic.
She's such an amazing character. I think that, I think it's very heartbreaking what her actual story is, but you never really feel bad for her, you know, because you kind of just imagine that this was sort of what was going to happen to her no matter how she died. She was always sort of going to be this miserable lady ruining things for people in a toilet. Which sounds very mean when I say it out loud, but, you know, she does give off that vibe, and I think that she's an amazing character, and how when Harry goes down, I don't know if that happens in the movie or if it's just in the book. I've not watched the movie in a while. But where Harry's going down into the Chamber of Secrets, she goes, well, if you die, you can share my toilet with me. I just think that's such a morbid quote, but it's also so very Moaning Myrtle, and it's kind of just icky, you know? You're just like, oh, just leave him alone.
It's a light-hearted bit of black comedy in a kid's film.
Yeah.
Just throwing back quickly to what you said before we get back onto Lady Myrtle, you mentioned the Death Day party. Am I making this up? I'm sure the word Halloween, was mentioned once in this film to kind of maybe, you know, throw allusions to that particular moment.
Yes, I think they do mention that Harry was at the Death Day party because that's the night when, is it the night that's the first petrifying happens?
So they have
to explain, you know, everyone's like, oh, well, it could have been Harry because he talks to snakes and, you know, or he's a bad guy and blah, blah, blah. And he wasn't at the feast, and Snape's all like, why weren't you at the feast? And Harry's like, because I went to a Death Day party because I'm a good guy.
which of course makes perfect sense out of context.
Yes.
I too was thinking about the feast because some of that food looks bloody awesome.
Oh my god, I think that's the one thing that I've always wanted about Hogwarts, but I've also wondered how, like, they're not all obese, because if I had just never-ending food that's great all the time, I'd be rolling to my classes. I wouldn't be walking.
You'd be JK rolling to the classes. Yeah, I went there. It's funny because most people would probably think, oh, I'd love to have an actual robe, or I'd love to live at Hogwarts or work, have the Ministry of Magic. You and me just want the feast.
I honestly,
we've got our priorities straight.
Best part of all of the films and all of the books is the food. But I mean, I did always wonder how they weren't just eating all the time. I think I am a Ron Weasley in that sense, you know. But at the same time, I guess they had all those stairs to walk up constantly, so that'd be a...
They look like they kept themselves busy for the most part. So and also children's metabolisms are a bit different, so they can eat what they want.
Very true.
Yeah, so, but yeah, if there was Academy Awards for Tucker, then I'm pretty sure that Potter would have won it.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I'm so glad I got the word Tucker in as well. but Moaning Myrtle, I thought she was such a fun character because she brought a kind of, like I said, a morbid sort of zaniness to the film, which I think before that hadn't really been seen in the film before and this one.
Yeah, and it does show that, I mean, it is kind of depressing when you think about it that there's a child ghost at Hogwarts. I mean, you never really think of it from that perspective. You just think, oh, she's one of the ghosts. But she's a child ghost, and that would be really, really sad.
Now I feel sad now you've put it like
that. Now that I think about it, it's quite sad to hear that she's a child and she's a ghost and you have to see her all the time. And yeah, she's annoying, so you never actually think about how sad that is. But, yeah.
We will avenge you, Myrtle. We will take down that basilisk for you.
Better, I think, now that I'm thinking about it.
Even though you've just called her annoying, she deserves better.
She is, though. Oh, my gosh.
I warmed to her.
Now that I think about her being a child ghost.
Good, she's not annoying, she's tragic and all right.
Yeah, that's the one.
Good, she says through gritted teeth.
Yeah.
And of course we get them, the riddle literally begins. The book that writes back, shall we say. We get to know more about Tom Riddle himself and his history as we go back 50 years prior to the film, which I thought was, I really liked that scene. And of course the false accusations against everybody's hero, Hagrid, getting taken to Azkaban. We get to see Azkaban, as we know it's going to play into the next few films. And then that obviously leads into going to see the spiders. But I really like that scene and the idea of that book, is because that's also quite a menacing kind of thing. We can write in this book like a Ouija board almost.
Yeah, and I think it's quite good to see what Hogwarts was like back when Tom Riddle was there, and you get to see Dumbledore and you get to see Hagrid, or sort of see him, I guess. And it's, I don't know, it's kind of like getting to have a glimpse into your parents' past. Like, have you ever looked at your parents' school books and you're like, so that's what they look like? I guess it's kind of one of those moments for me when I get to see them younger and actually dealing with Tom Riddle when they still don't know that he's going to be Voldemort. And it's a good scene. I like that. And I like that they go for a full sepia tone. They're like, yep, it's a flashback, guys. Don't you forget about it.
Remember, we need to have our hands held during this.
Yeah.
I'm surprised they didn't flash up at the bottom. This is a flashback.
Like a
reconstruction.
Yeah.
Make myself laugh there. Sorry. Was the Fantastic Beasts films, they're 100 years before, aren't they?
Who actually knows how old Dumbledore is? No, they're not 100 years ago, because they're filmed during the 20s in New York. So, and the final battle happened in 1996. So it would have only been
70 odd years.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking about the term. That flashback was 50 years previously. So the events of the Fantastic Beasts couldn't have happened that long ago in terms of that scene.
Yeah.
And Dumbledore looks nothing like Jude Law.
Regressively.
Yeah, another British stalwart there. But that's what I thought when I watched it. I was just trying to work out the timeline, because I'm one of those sticklers, aka knobs, who gets really hung up on timelines. Oh, yeah. So
I've always been so confused by the the Dumbledore Voldemort timeline, because, like, how old really? We never really get a good depth of how old Dumbledore is. You just know he's old balls.
He's just old.
That's it.
I don't want to see his old balls.
But that's how old he is, right? You never really get a number. You're not like, okay, Dumbledore's around 150. You're just like,
he's just presented as a very wise old wizard.
Yeah, he's been there since the dawn of time. That's all.
Yeah.
But then we get that this is what kind of annoys me about, you know, us getting all these new movies, is that Jude Law's kind of a young guy, right? And this is in the
He's in his 40s, I think.
Yeah, but he doesn't look like it. I mean, he's got that.
No, it's just, let's face it, he's annoyingly good looking.
Yeah. So I wouldn't call it annoying from my perspective, but
I would for mine.
But you know, he's quite young, and you have that in the 20s, right? Which it just doesn't seem to line up for me with how old he then is, you know, 70 years later. I don't know. I don't think that they quite matched it, especially because then you look at Grindelwald, who's played by Johnny Depp, and he just looks like time has not been good.
I was going to say it. Go on. Yeah. I thought you were going to swear then. Bloody hell. But yeah, I mean, that's what I mean. Fantastically, Jude Law is in the 1920s. So that flashback must have only been about 10 years after Fantastic Beasts, if the events of the films are, what, 10 years or whatever. Plus 50, obviously, this is elementary maths for you guys out there. 50 plus 10 is 60. So then it must have been at least between about 16 years before, which means that He must have had a bloody tough time in those 16 years, Dumbledore.
Rough for him. He did have to imprison his best friend slash lover slash take control of the most dangerous wand in the world. I guess he has had a rough time, but I was just...
It's just excuses.
Roughly 150 years old. That's always what I imagined anyway.
Well, I guess that's another discussion for another time. If we ever do a Fantastic Beasts episode, then we can really crack into that. But it's just something I found interesting, because I was trying to work out, because I do think, actually, that Jude Law does bear a striking resemblance to Richard Harris's character.
Hmm.
If you kind of look at the idiosyncrasies of their face and the way they look, there is a similarity. But I would have liked it to the timeline to be pushed back a bit more, just to kind of allow that suspension of belief that this guy became that guy in later life.
And also, when you think about the fact that, I mean, let's be real here, if Dumbledore looks like Jude Law, then Dumbledore was a whole snack, right? Like, he was a good-looking guy. And
sake.
And he fell in love with Grindelwald, who's played by skinhead, tattooed, old-ass-looking, wrinkly old Johnny Depp, and it just doesn't match up for me. How could you fall in love with someone who's, like, not even on the same level as you?
How could you be so shallow? It's what's on the inside that counts.
Trust me.
It's what's on the inside that counts.
Well, on the inside was racist crap, so, where are we going with this, really?
It's on the inside of the inside, then.
way inside.
Yeah. Somewhere in that man was something to love.
Yeah, sure.
Don't know where, but... Dumbledore found it.
Sure. Take your word for it, I guess.
Yes, this time you will do. Love has no boundaries. Even if it is clearly misguided sometimes in the case of that. But because I'm chucking back in, I like that. And again, I'm a lore fiend. I'm somebody who likes the history. And so I like it when they kind of build the world and the universe just that little bit. And I think that scene did that quite well.
I think that whole movie and that whole book do it really fantastically, because you do hear that history of Hogwarts, because you do find out that, you know, there is this chamber underneath the building, and you find out what people were doing with it back in the day, and you find out a little bit more about, you know, the Hogwarts founders that we don't get in that first movie.
Yes.
And I think that really, really excited me about the second book when I first read it, and it really excites me about the movie when I watch it, because... I don't know, just this idea that this castle has hidden depths and it has this sort of creepy past that you can read about. I mean, I've always been a bit of a history nerd myself, but only when it comes to, you know, the creepy or the weird. I loved reading stories about, you know, hidden things or like sort of dark pasts and sort of stuff like that, like trapdoors. I loved, it sounds really horrible when I say it out loud, but I loved reading about serial killers. So...
There is a morbid fascination with that. I'll give you that. I will give you that.
Like H.H. Holmes, who created this terrifying hotel full of trapdoors and different dungeons and stuff like that. Like it sort of evokes that same feeling when you read about the Chamber of Secrets. It's down there and someone created it for bad, bad reasons. So.
Yeah, and it's not like the sex room in 50 Shades of Grey. It was different.
I don't know if that would have been fully appropriate for a kids' movie, yeah.
Oh, shit, I've gone down a rabbit hole now.
Instead of
I've got to try and claw my way out of this. Well, maybe that's where Dumbledore took Grindel. I don't know. But yeah, you do find out more about the founders of Hogwarts, because obviously it's Godric Gryffindor's sword, which is... wielded by Harry at the end of the film. So again, there's just another, it's something like Star Wars, and that do very well in Lord of the Rings, where they'll mention something which you could probably give a massive backstory to, really interesting, which led up to that moment. So that's something else I enjoyed, and it kind of that, and you also get the revelation that, well, not the revelation we already knew, but Dumbledore telling Harry that, you know, he's different from Voldemort, so they are not one of the same, and there is a distinct path they're going to take.
Yeah, and I think You do get a lot of backstory and a lot of different things as well. Like you get to see the Slytherin common room. That's a really cool moment, I think. In fact, anything that happens with the Polyjuice potion, I loved that. I loved the idea that you looked like someone else. I absolutely loved that.
Crab and Goyle.
Yeah, I mean, bit of a bleak choice to make. If you wanted to turn into someone, I don't think they'd be my first choice, but...
No, but I bet the actors were quite happy to get a bit of screen time.
Yeah, that was their shiny moment.
Yeah, and Hermione got to turn into a giant cat. So
yeah, that was weird.
I know, it's just the way they built up to this scene, and then she kind of turns around and just looks like this really evil, ugly-looking cat. And you think,
just another way to get rid of Hermione in this movie so that you can focus a bit more on Ron. Yeah.
Is that lazy writing?
I don't know.
I'm going to say it is, right? Because they built her up to be so...
genius.
Well, you're genius and just so competent compared to these bumbling idiots, Harry and Ron, that it does kind of have that kind of deus ex machina where she can just come in and just save the day. So I guess I had to try and find some sort of creative way, and I guess J.K. Rowling had been on the source that night and thought, oh, cross, let's just turn her into a cat for a few days. That'll get her out of the picture.
Yeah, and I think that you do get a little bit more of the lazy writing as the books and movies come on. And she realises that she's set up these characters and these different devices as being almost too competent or too useful. And she's like, oh,
I could feel the anger seething out of you almost, or the frustration seething out of you.
Just wait until we get to Time Turners, honestly.
Without meaning to discard this episode, I'm so looking forward to the next few.
Me and Time Turners, honestly.
The fury of McGregor. Coming back to these ones, which keep your feet on the floor just a bit more than what's going to happen in the future. In terms of this film, same as the last one, what stood out for you? What did you like the best? You know, a couple of moments which really makes you think of this film.
The whole Chamber of the Secrets scene. Yeah. I love that. I think it's dirty. I think it's dark. And I think it's the bravest we've seen Harry so far. I mean, it was scary standing up to Voldemort in the first year, but he didn't really understand what he was facing. It was his first time meeting this guy. And, you know, he was sort of just, you know, the stakes didn't feel as high, I guess. But this one, I mean, there's a giant snake. A whole other level of bravery. That doesn't just take the level of bravery of I've got to save everyone and I've got to face this bad guy. You've also then got to deal with a snake who's giant. Like, that's terrifying. So I love that scene because it really endears me to Harry. And, gosh, what else did I love? I love everything about Ron in this movie in particular. I think he really stands out.
He has a lot more to do, doesn't he?
Yeah. That was when I really started to love him.
How could you not love Ron Weasley and Rupert Grint, for Christ's sake?
Yeah.
About the snake, actually, one of the moments I liked was when Harry actually starts talking to the snake in that after the duel between between Branner and Snape. After that scene, when he's actually talking to Snape, because that's quite that's another very important moment, because, like we mentioned, they touch upon it in the first film with the scene in London Zoo when he traps Dudley in the snake enclosure. And it kind of pays off now, which is what, I like when films have that sort of connecting tissue.
Yeah.
You don't realise it at the time, but it pays off. I like, because it's quite a, you know, everything sort of zones out, and then it's the first time that sort of Harry's connecting properly with, you don't know if it's good, evil, somewhere in between. So I quite enjoyed that very small moment. I like the little moments, I think.
Yeah. And I think it's quite interesting, that storyline as well, because it sort of shows you that, you know, Harry doesn't know everything about the wizarding world that others do. And even Hermione knows more than him because she's read all these books. And so when he says, well, can't like heaps of people talk to snakes? And they're like, oh my gosh, no.
No.
It's kind of that jarring moment where you're like, gosh, what else doesn't he know about?
Yeah, and he's put up as this sort of celeb. He's the man, isn't he? He's the person. He's the celebrity of Hogwarts, and he realised that actually he doesn't really know all that much, or he's just coming to terms with his own self and power. So that's another one of those kind of I wouldn't even call it subtle, but it's one of those smaller moments where it starts to chip away at what's to come.
Yeah, and I just remembered while you're talking, another one of my favourite scenes, which is the mandrakes when they're in Herbology and they've got these screaming fangs. Yeah. I just love that scene. That's a neat little scene.
It's a horrible noise, though.
I just really love it. I wish that they had the explanation that they have in the book, that the babies, what's her name? Professor, oh my gosh, I've forgotten the Herbology teacher's name. But she talks about how the pots have started to host parties and stuff, so they're in their teenage years and soon they'll be moving in with each other and stuff. And you just think about these children who are plants who are becoming adults, and they're doing things like parties and stuff. I just love that. I love it.
Obviously, when Morgan's having a quiet couple of minutes, she clearly daydreams about what the mandrakes get up to in her spare time.
I really do. I wish I could have had more of that. I love it.
We're through the looking glass now. We know what you're like, really. You're one step away from Britney Spears and you think about mandrake parties.
Absolutely.
God knows what's going to happen in the next few episodes. I can't argue with any of those scenes. I liked Moaning Myrtle, sorry. Mm. I know you found her annoying, and don't try and backtrack now. but I liked her. I thought she had just gave a sort of weird, zany dynamic to the film. And she also had that most wonderful of lines. I like the creatures they introduced to this film. And obviously they mentioned the basilisk. The spiders and of course a massive snake. So you start to realise, like you said about before, you've got this overarching villain who loses the nose. So apparently, as the films go on, Voldemort. But then you've got these other obstacles to deal with. One of them may be in the form of someone like Malfoy, but then there's things like massive snakes just come into the picture. So it starts to build up that this isn't going to be an easy path to the end.
Yeah, and you start thinking, oh, maybe I don't want to be in a world where giant murderous snakes exist, you know? Like, for so long, you're like, yeah, I'd love to be in the Harry Potter world. And then you start thinking,
You start getting a bit fickle. One snake and everybody backs away.
I don't know. That's when I was like, oh, this place is kind of scary. We don't have giant snakes at my school.
I did see some strange things in the toilet, but it wasn't a snake. It may well be, but I'd love to use the juice to be able to turn into somebody else for an hour, as long as it's not a cat. That could be quite fun, I think.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I just loved the concept of Polyjuice Potion. I think that's really powerful as a tool, because you never really know who to trust, which I guess I touch on two books and two movies later. But I think it was such an interesting moment, and it really did show Hermione's prowess again. I mean, she didn't get a lot of opportunities in this film. She figures out the plot and everything, but, you know, she gets petrified, so she can't do it. But you do see her brew this fantastically difficult potion, and it's very impressive. I love that.
Even though it turns into a cat,
yeah.
It took a month to brew it properly.
She had a Nicholas moment
in the toilet.
Yeah.
Yes, she did have a Nicholas moment. Well, good analogy there. I like that. Yeah, what these two films did, I think, was give the three lead characters a sort of a jumping-off point to let us as the audience really invest in their characters, because as we know, with hindsight, the next few, obviously the films afterwards, aren't exactly all going to be sunshines and fairies for them.
Yeah.
The going gets tough fairly quickly, so what these two films did, I think, was really set them up and their characters and give us people to root for.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, I don't know, it's really nice to watch them have the opportunity to be children. You don't get that enough in the other
points.
You only get it slightly. And I think it's great to watch them have, you know, normal people problems like homework and, you know, Quidditch matches and stuff like that. And I think that really, allows us a time to get to know them as children, and also it feels good because when you look back on it, you're like, okay, like they did have some good times. It wasn't all, you know, fighting villains.
It wasn't all massive snakes and people trying to kill them all the time. There was some fun, but it's like homework. if you've ever seen the Red of the Cursed Child, it doesn't get much better. To be speaking about that Quidditch, there is a very quick game of Quidditch in the film, and yes, Harry gets that golden snitch, so it sets him up to be this wonderful Quidditch player, and again going forward. But there's also a wicked moment in the scene if you're a geek like me, because some of the movie was mixed at Lucasfilm Ranch in California by Skywalker Sound, and there's one moment I can vividly remember where the golden snitch zooms past Harry in the camera, and that sounds just like a TIE fighter. I think they may have sampled it in. It sounds just like it, and it's whether they meant to or not, but it sounds exactly like a TIE fighter. And
it's
like quite a cool little Easter egg.
I've never noticed that. Oh, I'm gonna have to rewatch it.
It will take me all night to try and remember what part it is. But
it's in the Quidditch scene, though, so I trust.
Yeah, it's in the scene, so it's fairly. I think it's one of the first moments when it zooms past him for the very first time. You can just kind of hear it. And I thought, wow, that's pretty cool as a TIE fighter. And then I remembered it, we were watching Harry Potter, and I still thought, that's pretty cool as a TIE fighter in Harry Potter.
would be cool to have TIE fighters in the Harry Potter universe.
Yeah, I would like to know who'd be piloting them, though.
Harry, obviously.
Of course. He would need to be in it.
The great seeker.
Just put a broomstick underneath it and washes off.
His mitochondria level will be off the charts. Imagine it.
Get off this show. Mentioning that. I forgot there's another cool moment, actually, just quickly. It's when Lockhart tries to mend Harry's broken arm and dissolves his bones.
That actually grossed me out so much. That was, when I think about it now. It's like
this horrible squelching, moist noise that it makes.
No, I don't like this.
It's like a dog licking its water.
Oh my god.
Supping, sorry.
Oh, hate it. I hate it.
We've grossed her out. We've found out what winds her up, and she doesn't like tragic ghosts. So here you go, guys. We know how we're starting to pluck away at the real Morgan now. So again, a stupid question, but did you like this? Did you like this film? Did it stack up to the first film?
Yes.
Was it a worthy sequel?
I think it was a worthy sequel. I think it's almost nearly as on par as the first one, almost. And yeah, I think it was a fantastic film. I love it. I don't like the book as much as the first book, but when it comes to the films, I love them.
That's interesting that you the switch up there. I did like this film. Again, there were certain parts of it which the editing was what got me. There were some scenes. There was one moment where Harry's in his hospital little bed after he's had his bendy, moist arm. And then he kind of, the next scene very quickly cuts to him walking towards the staircase where Ron and Hermione are waiting for him.
Yeah.
And it's such a jarring cut. Things like that I can't help but notice because it feels like the film's buffering almost, even though it's a Blu-ray disc.
Yeah.
So some of the editing was quite jarring, but story-wise I enjoyed it. That's more of a technical aspect. I thought the acting was better in this film, which I am pleased to say that, because in the first film there were moments where it was a bit touch and go, but in this film it's clear, obviously, that you know the guys had really, really started to understand their characters even more. They'd grown into them. The technical side of the acting had got better. So I'm not going to say whether I prefer this film or not, because I'm going to leave that to the last show. But I did enjoy this film a lot.
That's good. I think that it deserves the praise you give it.
Well, thank you. I'm glad somebody recognises my praise as meaning something. If only you'd give the same to Moaning Myrtle, this would be a better world.
Hey, she's heartbreaking, all right? I've come to that conclusion today.
Okay, well, we'll see how you feel in the next episode if you've gone back to your awful ways.
I might feel that way about her in the fourth one. We'll see.
There you go. See, I told you, and that is actually in the next episode. We'll cover the fourth one. So that wraps up episode one of Pottercasts, covering the Philosopher's Stone and the Chamber of Secrets. We will be back again with episode three and episode four. And if you think Morgan started to rampage now, God knows what she's going to be like in this next episode.
Oh my God!
And then the one after that. Holy moly! I'm looking forward to that. So I know you'll all be chomping at the bit with boneless bendy arms. There will be more of us soon. So in the meantime, where on earth can the world find you on the internet, Morgan?
They can find me at manicpixiefilmgirl.com. I've just updated my website to look way cooler than it did before. So I invite everyone to go look at it and pick it to pieces. And you can find me at Morgan Louise McGregor on Instagram, where I post about cool jackets that I wear and eating food.
Cover your ears, kids. It's a fucking cool jacket. The website does look good. I'm not blowing smoke. I do mean that. It does. I saw that you'd updated it, and it's a nice, sleek-looking site. It was before, to be fair. But I like it. I think it looks bloody good, and you should all check it out.
Thank you. I agree.
I hope so. Is it... see Morgan's views on films, and not just film reviews, actually the wider world of films and issues going on. It's very interesting, and it's some eye-opening reads on there, so do go check it out. You can find me at whatiwatchtonight.co.uk, and glumping around on Twitter and Instagram. Just search What I Watch Tonight and you'll find me on there. There's movie reviews, podcasts and all that good stuff to keep you entertained for all the rest of your life, I guess. So you can hear this show, this particular episode, which you're listening now. You can hear it on iTunes. You'll find it on Spotify, TuneIn, Podknife, Stitcher, possibly on YouTube, may or may not be. I'm very slowly getting them up on there. Or the website. There's plenty of places to hear this. So like I say, we will be back soon with episodes 3 and 4. I'm looking forward to it because I've had a bloody good time tonight with you, Morgan.
Thank you. I've had fun too.
Excellent. And I'm looking forward to jousting wands with you on the next two films. I can't tell if we're going to have contrasting opinions or not, but I'm looking forward to it. So
we'll see.
Yes, I think we might do. So it leaves nothing more than thank you everybody for listening. If you like this show, do share it with people you know. It's nothing better than letting people know you've heard something good. Do let us know you like what you hear as well. If you don't agree with us, let us know in a nice way or else I will block you and so will Morgan. But, you know, if you like what you hear, let us know. Share it, tell the world. If you don't like what you hear, shut up. Don't tell anybody. It never happened. So from that side, it's... it's goodbye and see you from me and from Morgan.
See you later, I guess. Yeah, next time.
See you later from the future. See you later from the past. So thank you for listening and we will be back soon. So until then, see ya.
See ya.
Yeah.